I'm a slowly recovering Al-Anon. My name is Rick Jatuk. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming to an Al-Anon talk at 9:30 in the morning. Bet if you had known when you're out there drinking that you could stop drinking and have a chance to come to a room like this, 9:30 on a Saturday morning, and listen to one of us talk to you, you would have stopped drinking a lot earlier. Anyway, as they're known to say in Omaha, by the grace of God and the power of a program called the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, a fellowship called the Al-Anon Family Groups, the loving and very firm guidance of a big book, Black Belt Al-Anon sponsor, it has not been necessary for me to plan any kind of death, yours or mine, since the 10th day of April, 1987, and for that I am grateful. My hometown is Toronto, Ontario, Canada. My home group is the St. Clair Al-Anon Family Group. We meet every Tuesday night in the Church Hall of Holy Rosary Catholic Church, located on the north side of St. Clair Avenue between Spadina Road and Bathurst Street. If you're ever in Toronto on a Tuesday night, like to come to our really nifty little Al-Anon meeting, come by and join us. We'd love, 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 love to see you. Certainly enjoyed both of those talks we heard last night. Mari, Carl, applause for both of them. Outstanding. I'd like to congratulate Mari for becoming a citizen of Canada. Fantastic. Yay. I'd like to congratulate Carl for being allowed to keep his citizenship in the United States. After hearing that story last night, amazing they allowed you to stay. I'd like to thank the person responsible for the colorizing on the video. I actually look white. Mari looked like she came from Jamaica. I want to thank Deborah for her role in getting me here, and Nancy for making the call, the committee for the astonishing organization that happens in this particular deal. This is my experience anyhow, one of the best run things I've seen. And especially for inviting Lise, my partner, with me. So it's thrilling to have her here with me. And so thanks for all of that. This is actually the second time I've been here. I was at the Gopher State Roundup in 2001. Not so sure Nancy knew that when she called me. She called and invited me to come, and I said, "Hey, well, I was there before." She said, "Were you?" And in my mind's thinking, I thought it was a good talk. How soon they forget. So whether you remember or not, I do, and I'm very, very happy to be here. It's not the first time I've been in, first or second time I've been in Minneapolis. The very first time I ever spoke outside of Canada was in Minneapolis at the Al-Anon conference, and that's just a weird thing. And you're just kind of doing your program the best you can do, and a phone call comes and says, "Hey, do you want to come to Minnesota?" What? How does that happen? And I really don't know, to be quite honest with you. But I was glad to come, and I'm glad to. Glad to have been back, and of course I was here for the International in 2000, and for many years said that it was absolutely the best International I'd ever been to, and then we did the one in Toronto. Second best is okay, really. I had the pleasure of working on the hosting committee for that, as I know many of you did, and it's an experience I will never, never forget. I'd like to thank Deborah for picking me up at the departure level at the airport. She phoned me and said, I'll meet you at the Northwest counter. So we found a Northwest sign on the arrival level. And Deborah phoned me from the departure level and said, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm arriving today, Deborah. It's Thursday. I'll be departing on Sunday." So you do many fine organizational things here. So a note to the person that's responsible for the guidelines to the hosts. Put a little note, pick up speaker on arrival level. Departure level, bring them back on Sunday. Keep coming back, baby. You'll be ready. You'll be okay. My favorite stories are the pickup at the airport stories. You know, oftentimes they're standing there. Well, I'll know who you are. And you know, I always know who they are because they look like a deer in the headlights. But the funniest one that ever happened was about a year and a half ago. I was at a thing in Vancouver, and a guy was standing there. I was picking up my bag, and there was a fellow standing there holding up a blank piece of cardboard. Ripped from a like kind of a flap from a box, and I looked around, didn't see anybody else. I thought, I wonder. So I go up to him and say, hi, my name's Rick. Is there any chance you're here to pick me up? And he looked at the other side of the cardboard and said, as a matter of fact, I am. And turned it around and my name was facing him. My next question is, can you tell me where I can phone a taxi? Thank you for the basket of fruit. Nice chocolate. Another favorite thing I like to giggle about are the baskets. It's at a deal a few weeks ago, and it wasn't a basket. It was a cardboard box. I was happy to open it up. I think there might be a chocolate bar in there. It's filled with mustard. And a bottle of pickled asparagus. I'm looking for a Snickers bar, but I'm hungry, so I'll try it. So I open up the jar, pickled asparagus, dip it in Bing cherry mustard. Yum! Didn't quite make it like a Snickers bar did. The best one, however, was in Texas. A riot. I walk in the room, and there's this beautiful basket, amber-colored paper, can't see what's inside. I'm hungry, want a Snickers bar. Open up the basket, and there is a fine selection of quality hair care products. They obviously had never seen a picture of me. But I do appreciate the basket I got here. And I really, truly do appreciate being here. And I really, truly do appreciate you being here this morning. In Al-Anon, we have this tradition that says the only qualification for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or friend, which means that in Al-Anon, we have to qualify. Because we all know that anybody can join AA. You have to know somebody to get into Al-Anon. And I'm here to tell you that I've known five of them. Two by birth, father and a grandmother, my father's mother. But perhaps a little more germane to the story that I need to share with you this morning, I've chosen three. Two of them I met in Al-Anon. I kind of have the radar. I don't have any obsession with alcohol, but I love female alcoholics. And I can find you anywhere. So I'd just like to simply tell you this, that if you are a female and you're in Al-Anon and you think you might have a problem with alcohol, ignore any questions that AA might give you to see if you have a problem with alcohol. Just simply come up to me at the end of this talk and say, do you find me attractive? And if the answer is yes, run like hell to AA. I have a great speaker that I've met a few times, a fellow from California, and he talks about the words and the music. I teach music for a living. I'm a high school band director. I understand music. So does he. He's a fabulous musician, and he talks about the kind of the lyrics and the music, and you can hear the words, but the words come alive even more when you add the music. And the music of our rooms is the laughter. I have to have the laughter if the words are really going to make any sense. They become powerful when I'm allowed to sit with you in my meeting on a Tuesday night, when I'm allowed to talk with the guys that I sponsor, when we come to these fantastic get-togethers, and we laugh at things that we could not utter to another human being before. When we say things like, I haven't had to plan to kill anybody for 20 years, and everybody laughs. There's something, and we all nod our heads up and down. Take a look, that's happening right now. There's a power of identification that I need to have. If I was to stand in front of the parents of the students I get to teach and say, hey parents, thanks for coming out to the meeting. Glad to talk to you about our plans for the coming year. And by the way, I haven't had to plan any kind of death, yours or mine, since the 10th day of April 1987. They would not clap. My job would end quickly. But here we get it. We get what that means. We get that particular insanity that says the only way out is to end you or to end me. We get it. Is that not a fantastic definition of insanity? We talk about insanity all the time as being the definition being doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Fantastic definition. But another one is that when I truly believe that ending you or ending me is a legitimate solution to my problems, I am clearly in trouble. And that is clearly a state of insanity for me. I have no memory of a time before alcoholism. It has been there as long as my memories have been there. There was never a magic day when somebody sat me down and said, "Hey, Rick, guess what? This is alcoholism. Your father's an alcoholic. Your grandmother's one." No, it just never happened. It has simply always been there. And I developed into just being any kind of kid that would develop in alcoholism. And I want to be clear about that right from the beginning. But I have not been affected by an alcoholic. I love alcoholic people. Some of the finest people I know on this planet are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. They call themselves alcoholics. But what our tradition says is that when a problem of alcoholism in a relative or friend, and I have been affected by a disease called alcoholism, and that's what was in my home. There was an alcoholic person, and he didn't choose alcoholism. Alcoholism just came in. However it came, and I've never heard any AA speakers say they know exactly how it comes. We don't need to know. All we know is that it's there. And I picked it up. I became affected by alcoholism, and after a while, I became inflicted with it, even though I didn't drink. So I have a disease called alcoholism, the family disease. And it started to manifest itself in me at a very young age. I was nervous all the time. I was anxious all the time. I couldn't stand being with people, yet I desperately wanted to be. I was in the bathroom a lot. I peed all the time. Just relieved the pressure. I threw up a lot. It's the only way. It just did. There was just pressure there all the time. Nobody was doing that to me. Alcoholism was present in the home. And everybody in the home was dealing with alcoholism in the only way that they knew how, without a program. And it's insanity. And I don't need to describe all that insanity to you, but that's what was going on in my home. My mother got frightened. She brought me to a doctor. They gave me this test. They thought I might have allergies, all this kind of other stuff. And nothing showed up. But I continued to spend a lot of time in the bathroom. I was throwing up all the time. I was afraid of everybody because I had alcoholism, the family disease. And nobody was doing it to me. And that is an important thing for me to know. Because for many years, as a member of Al-Anon, as an Alateen, actually many years ago, member of Alateen and then into Al-Anon, I did think it was because of you. And that's the classic Al-Anon deal. It's you. And it really, really isn't. One of the strange things I would do would be I'd lock myself in a closet in my bedroom. I would take out all the clothes and move in a little table and a little chair, and I'd hang a light over the bar, and I'd make up a big sign that said, "Keep out!" And I'd paste it on the outside of the door, and I'd go inside the closet and wonder why nobody would come in. And as I grew older, I'd build little enclosures. I was always building things to protect myself, and I was always putting out those signs, "Keep out!" And I'd go inside and wonder why nobody would come in. And as a metaphor for my life, that's a good one. Because my need and my urge has always been, my deepest wants has been for you to come in. I've wanted to connect. But there was something that just did not allow me to do that. Nobody did that to me. Alcoholism was present. Now, I have an alcoholic in the home. At this time, I was young. My dad, he liked to drink a lot. My dad liked to do a few things. He liked to drink, he liked to garden, he liked to take off his clothes, do it in those order. Met a lot of alcoholics who liked to take their clothes off. A few of the women I went out with, those alcoholic women, they liked to do it too. That was good. When your father does it, it's not so good. So he'd start gardening in the backyard in the morning and start drinking in the morning, and by midday, he's out front. And everything had started to come off, and he'd had God knows how many drinks. And he really wasn't totally naked. Everything was off except the Bermuda shorts, and he rolled them down as far as they could go and rolled them up. They kind of, imagine turning Bermuda shorts into a thong. That's really what it looked like. And this was in the days before people were afraid of the sun, and so he wouldn't even put suntan lotion on it, just oil to attract the sun. Kind of looked like a greased pig, actually. And there we were. Inside, and there's Dad out there showing the world. And he had an anger issue too, and we had this guy on the street that used to, he would race cars and motorcycles and stuff up the street. And one day, my dad just got pissed. and went chasing after him. The guy stopped, got out, and they had this to-do in the middle of the street. And there was my dad in the thong, the beer bottle, the cigarettes, the guy in the motorcycle, and the street all gathered around. And there we are, the family, on the inside, embarrassed to show our face. Dad's out there showing his ass. We can't show our face. And isn't that one of the classic symptoms of the family disease called alcoholism? They do it. We're ashamed. Years later, I'm happy to tell you, my dad got sober. That's a good thing. And you get the bumper stickers in the back of the car. Easy does it. Let go and let God. What does my mother say to my father? For God's sake, Donald, why do you have those bumper stickers in the back of the car? Everyone's going to see them. I said, Mom, they've seen everything else. But isn't that the ongoing legacy of alcoholism, the family disease? We don't want anybody to see anything. We don't want to be seen in the act of drinking. We don't want anybody to know their sobriety. We don't want anybody to know. We want to hide. The irony is that everybody knows everything. People would wake up in our street and find the contents of our house on the front lawn, and we were not moving. That was just one of those deals. Well, there's that car at 5 Gauge, wrecked up again. Well, at least now, when he's sober, it's not wrecked up and it's got bumper stickers, but we're ashamed that the bumper stickers are on there. Now, who's that about? That is not about the alcoholic. As much as those of us in Al-Anon want it to be. Isn't that our grandest illusion in Al-Anon? If you stop drinking, I'll be okay. Listen to that. Listen to the selfishness of the Al-Anon. Here's someone we love, and they have a disease that they don't want, that is killing them. And all that we can think about is us. And how uncomfortable I am. And the only solution we were ever able to find in my home when there was active drinking was to have the active drinking stop. We never once, not once, thought to look at ourselves, because we blamed it all on the alcoholic. I think it's in the DNA of the Al-Anon, and it takes a long time, and sometimes it never happens. If this program is going to work for us, there is a must, an absolute ironclad have to, in my opinion. And the have to is this: I have to let go of the illusion that my problems will be solved when the alcoholic stops drinking, because they are not. The only problem that is solved is they are not drinking. Everything else continues. As a matter of fact, our problems can get worse. Because when we get that thing that we think we want and nothing changes, where do we go then? That's kind of an Al-Anon bottom, isn't it? And that's a hard thing for people in Al-Anon to hear. And it was a hard, hard, hard thing for this Al-Anon to accept. And I'd like to be able to tell you it happened quick, and it did not. It was a long time before I was truly willing and able to let go of that illusion that the problem is them. A long, long time. When I was 11 years old, a beautiful thing happened to me. My mother introduced me to Alateen. It was in 1968. Amazing, really. And a beautiful thing happened. 4 members of Alateen from Kalamazoo, Michigan, walked into my front door. They were here in Toronto for a conference, so my mother had opened up the house to say, active alcoholic home. My mother was in Al-Anon. My mother had been introduced to Al-Anon at the first international conference in Toronto in 1965. Very, very interesting. And so she said, hey, I'll take these 4 Al-Ateens into this active alcoholic home, because she knew she had this wonky little kid in her house. And she knew that the help she was getting in Al-Anon was available to her son. And then take a look at her son as years go on by, and he looks at his resentments. And the resentments for looking at a mother that never cared for him. How blind the disease makes us. How self-centered, how selfish the family disease of alcoholism is. because all I could see is what was not done for me. And take a look at all the unbelievable things my mother did do for me. And so she brought this program into my life. And an amazing thing happened when they walked in. Somebody looking at it was not amazing. All they saw was a young kid standing talking to four teenagers. But inside me, it was a revolution. Because for the first time in my young life, I felt this one thing. I belong. It's okay to be with these people. And what a beautiful feeling that was when I never kind of felt like I fit anywhere. Look here, all the alcoholics today. I could tell the story, and if I took the side that said I started drinking, I'd have a great alcoholic story. I tried the booze, it didn't work for me. I'm one of those sick, disgusting social drinkers. Take a bottle of beer, take the cap off, have half of it, put the cap back on and put it back in the fridge. What? Told that to a dear friend of mine at home. Mildred is her name. You might know Mildred. Very, very dear friend of mine. And she said, Rick, that's alcohol abuse. She turned ashen when I told her that. Mildred often comes to visit me on Christmas, and she came over one Christmas morning, and one of our Christmas traditions is that we'll have a bit of champagne and orange juice. And when I say a bit, when an Al-Anon says a bit, we mean a bit. So there were four of us, and we put a little bit of champagne in the orange juice and kind of half drank it. And when by the time Mildred got there, we had finished doing that part of our Christmas morning, and there was half of the champagne bottle left. And as Mildred was walking in the kitchen, my sister was dumping the rest of it down the drain. She went, That's just the way our approach is to alcohol. It just doesn't do it. But remember, I have alcoholism, the family disease. I don't have that manifestation of wanting to drink. That just doesn't do it for me. An alcoholic person, a baby, nothing like it. Nothing like it for me. Trying to fix somebody, nothing like it. Love that. And I went to Alateen and they told me some amazing things. They said, Rick, your father has a disease. He is not a disgrace. Oh God, listen to that. You're a kid. All that you're hearing at home is how bad this father is. Look, if he loved us, he wouldn't be doing this. You're waking up in the middle of the night and you're hearing all the stuff you hear in the middle of the night in active alcoholism. You wake up in the morning and the furniture's out in the lawn. And that's not an exaggeration, by the way. I'm not making that up. You see, all these things, you know, the wake up neighbors at night are saying, why is your father sitting outside throwing tea bags at cats? I don't know. It's his keen alcoholic mind. He would do that. We'd be embarrassed. All that kind of stuff happened, right? So you think, what is this? And they tell me, Rick, your father has a disease. He is not a disgrace. Thank God. I am so glad to know that. He is not doing those things on purpose, Rick. He has a disease. He wakes up in the morning and he probably wants to have a great day. He takes a drink and the disease kicks in and on it goes. Wow. What a beautiful thing to know. I'm going to extend that. If you're a child grew up in alcoholism, the non-alcoholic parent had a disease too. And the mother or the father or any of the others, they're affected by alcoholism as well. Because I blamed the non-alcoholic parent for a long time. But you know what? She has a disease too. And she is not a disgrace. She's my mother. And my father has a disease. And he is not a disgrace. He's my father. And 12 steps practiced with a sponsor have allowed me to cut through the resentment and the blame and the anger and the rage and the self-righteousness to see two beautifully loving people. My father is an intelligent, humorous, loving, caring man who has a disease called alcoholism. My mother is a loving, humorous, giving, beautiful person who has a disease called alcoholism, the family disease. And she has a son who has a disease too. And it's called alcoholism, the family disease. I loved my time in Alateen. I stayed in there for 10 years. They kicked me out when I was 21. They said, Rick, you can't be bald and have a beard and still be in Alateen. I don't want to go home! So I reluctantly went to Al-Anon and hung out in Al-Anon for 5 years, found a harem. Lovely little group, you know, of women, and oh man, you know, they kind of thought I was cute. Love that, massaged my ego, that was really great. And occasionally another guy would make the mistake of coming down the stairs into the meeting, Agent Cordell Al-Anon. And my hand would go out and say, welcome. My eyes would say, get lost. This is my group, find your own women. Clearly, I was not practicing any kind of program, but I was attending a fellowship. And I think there's a warning somewhere around that about not getting fellowship confused with program, because I did. I'm embarrassed to tell you that of 10 years I spent in Alateen, and of those 5 years I hung out in Al-Anon before I left, because I'm in Al-Anon retread. I've been in 20 years the second time. I didn't do a program. I thought I was doing a program. But you know, the big problem is our thinking. As my sponsor said very early on, Rick, your mind is a very dangerous place. Do not go in alone. And I was in there alone all the time. And I would never really tell you what was going on. And that can happen. I was at a conference where I met Deborah, actually, about a year and a half ago. And after I spoke, a woman came up to me and said, you know, I've been in Al-Anon 30 years. And I have not done an inventory. My response was, it's not too late. And it's never too late. Because you see, in Al-Anon, we can get hung, and I was one of them, on it's them. Now we come here and it's fun. Fellowship is great. We get to laugh a lot. There's a lot of, you know, wisdom on the walls, and get people to kind of understand a little bit. But there needs to come that point where we say, it's me. We have to. We come in there. It's them. Show me how to get them to stop drinking so I will be okay. And if God's grace comes into our life, which it will if we are open enough, we are allowed to cross a bridge to the other side that says, it's me. And what's wrong with me is not dependent on whether the alcoholic is drinking or sober, alive or dead, living near me or living afar from me. It is irrelevant. It is about what I carry around. After the third alcoholic relationship I had ended, it became abundantly clear to me that she was not the problem. It took me a long time to go, duh, I'm the one doing the picker, or the picking, as we all have heard, you know, you had a broken picker. I thought my picker was working just fine. They were exciting, and whenever I met them, my picker really worked, I'll tell you. It was great. So let's take a look at this. Here we are, we're in Al-Anon. We come here, why? Even our public information stuff says this. Is alcohol a problem in your home? Damn right! And show me how to get rid of it and I'll be okay. It's kind of like the Al-Anon con. Come here, little girl. Come here, little boy. Is alcohol causing a problem? Yes. Come to our meeting. We'll tell you how to fix that. We here, they'll tell us how to get them to stop drinking. Yes, I'm coming. And you come into the meeting and all you want to do is talk about him, them, and her. And we say, no, we don't talk about that. What? And we start hear people talking about doing an inventory and looking at ourselves. And I don't want to look at myself. It's boring. It's a lot more fun to talk about you. Isn't that sad? But we do that to ourselves. Because the reality is we have lives that are thrilling, they're exciting, that we can have one of those things, but if you are like me, you set it all aside and lived under this blanket that said, it's them, and if they'll change, I'll be all right. Didn't work. Didn't work for me. So if you're willing to buy into this, if you're willing to do it, if you're not in Al-Anon this morning and pissed off at me because I'm disturbing you, if you're willing to listen to what I have to say, let's take a look at what's wrong with us. Us, apart and separate from anything that the alcoholic people we love do. Let's take a look at us. What is it in our lives that destroy our lives when the alcoholic is drunk or sober, alive or dead, with us or not? What is that? What is that about us that when we leave one, we find another? How many have chosen one? Put up your hand. This is a real question. How many people have chosen two? How many people have chosen three? Look at the hands. That happens everywhere. Your country and mine, that happens. Is that about them? I think not. How many people have left one alcoholic and gone to AA to meet another? There you go! Who's that about? Who's that about? A great little line, smart little line. Somebody says to me, if you're coming to our fellowships to find a partner, the odds are good, but the goods are odd. It's not my line, but I love it, so I stole it. So what is it? Here's what it is for me. Politely, Ian always say, I have low sense of self-esteem. No kidding. I'm finally happy to rise up to low sense of self-esteem. You know, it's just kind of that belly low. But here's how mine showed up. Because nobody ever said you're dumb, ugly, or stupid. Ever. They never said that to me. But somewhere along the way, in the midst of this disease, I got that message. And so, I would not buy a pair of pants. Because there's three mirrors when you buy a pair of pants. You got to look at yourself. I hated looking in the mirror. Hated looking at my own image. Couldn't stand getting my hair cut. The barber stands behind you and said, how do you want to look? Well, I want to disappear. Hated it. When I started teaching high school, the call would come out kind of in late October, early November. Teachers have to go down and get their pictures taken for the yearbook. Well, I hated to have my picture taken. So if you take a look at this first 6 years of my career, there's no picture of me in the yearbook. You go to the staff page, and there's an empty spot. Picture not available. Here I have two university degrees, and I'm afraid to get my picture taken. What's that about? That because my dad drank too much beer? I think not. That is something that I was doing to me. And that's the disease that's in me starting to work its way out and worm its way out in all these strange, odd little ways. Somebody pointed a camera at me and make a funny face because who I am isn't good enough. So I had to hide. I'd either say, I don't want to have my picture taken, or I'd make a funny face to hide. Because nothing scared me more than me. Politely, we say we are people pleasers. Really. I never wanted to please you in my life. The only thing I ever wanted from you was approval. If I could do something that you would approve of, it will, for me, for a minute in time, it would allow me to feel like I belonged. So I am not a people pleaser. I am an approval sucker. And I will do anything I can, however length of time I can, to get that approval. Because when I have not accepted that a higher power called God can lead my life, I need a higher power called your approval to get through. So in Al-Anon, we get to step two later on, you know, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, I'm here to tell you that this Al-Anon knew that for his whole life. Because I made all kinds of things my higher power, and approval was one of them. If you could approve of me for a brief moment in time, I felt all right. And then it would go away, and in my sick thinking, I'd think, well, it worked once, I'll do more, and I'll get it again. And I'd get it again, and it'd feel okay for a little while, and it would disappear, because it became my God. It's like a sick step, too. Or we meet somebody. Doesn't that person become our God? Alcoholics love that part of the story. When I got my sponsor, she told me that I was to start a daily routine. And one element of my daily routine is to wake up every morning and say out loud, good morning, God. And when I started that, I was with the third alcoholic in my life. So I woke up in the morning and I said, good morning, God. She rolled over and said, hello. She loved it. Sponsor telling the alcoholic. It's amazing. But I started to actually talk to the real, real God. But that's the sixth step, too. I was involved in for a long time. But there's other things that we do if you're an Al-Anon like me. And one of the number one thing on my hit parade is I absolutely need to have somebody need me. And if I have that, that lasts for a long time. That's better than a bottle that, you know, you hear alcoholics tell their stories and they drink and then they get sober and they got to do it again. I'll tell you, when you find a female alcoholic that needs you, that's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. It's there constant. Yeah. And it helps if you're sick, like me. That's a sixth step, too. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Hello, Susan. Right? There it is. There's me doing that. No alcoholic is doing that to me. I am manifesting that in my own life. And that's the important message. So I was in Al-Anon those 5 years, hanging out with those women. Found myself in my second year of university. I had applied to go to a school in Alberta, a school in a place called Banff. I was accepted to go to the school. It was a music training facility. I was accepted into a program for brass musicians, playing small groups, quintets. And the person that accepted me into the program said, why don't you contact the other four members of your group, have a few rehearsals before you come to the school. You'll be a little farther ahead when the program starts. Great idea. So I found three of the other four members to arrange time for a rehearsal, and then I found her. And I'm here to tell you that an Al-Anon like me can find you even without seeing you. Because I started talking to her, and what was supposed to be this short little conversation to arrange a practice place and a practice time turned into this hour-long lust fest. And she was amazing! And I'd never even seen her before. And she had been places I wanted to go, and she'd met people I wanted to meet, and she'd played music with people that I wanted to play music with, and she was exciting, and she was alive, and she was vibrant, and I was vibrating after I hung up the phone. Now, an Al-Anon like me is a good investigator, too. I find out. I want information. We're good at that. And so I started asking around about her, and I found out some great things. One is she's a fantastic musician, and that's true to this very, very day. Found out that she was very cute, and that's a good thing. And I found out that she was super experienced, and that was really exciting because I was not. At least not with other people. I had to do something in that closet. I love the laughter of identification. Thank you very much. Anyhow, we met and it was magic. And one day I'm working in my summer job. I worked in the LCBO, if you can believe that, Liquor Control Board of Ontario. Largest purchaser of alcoholic products on the planet. That's where I worked for my summer job. And this woman that I had just, you know, kind of talked to and met once phoned me and she was drunk. And she said, you know, my boyfriend was supposed to come over. He didn't come over. I drank this bottle of wine. Why don't you come over? 10 years in Altine, about 4.5 years in Al-Anon. A little part in my brain goes, not good. But then another part of my whole body went, yes! I can help you with that, baby. Because in all of these conversations we've been having on the phone and the one time we met, she'd been telling me about all kinds of things that have been going on. And me, loving to have someone that I can fix, going, he did what? I can help you with that. That happened? Oh, darling, I can help you with that. You drink? I can help you with that! And so this magic day came and we were heading off to the school out in Banff, and I'm at the airport with my mom and my dad and they're sending their little guy off, and in comes Susan. And guys, she was bouncing. Oh, I only seen them in pictures. It was glorious. And up she comes and she had this beautiful little blue top on and her hair was glistening and she had her suitcase and her trumpets and she came right up and this fantastic energy. She said, hi! And bent right over with her suitcases and her trumpets. My mother went into mild cardiac arrest right in the spot. Eyes popped right out of my dad's head, and I'd been in Altine and Al-Anon long enough to know I was about to have a spiritual experience. And away we went. We got on that plane, and so, you know, we ordered a drink, and I ordered a beer. And in Al-Anon, when an Al-Anon says they order a beer, they mean one. She ordered one, and two, and three, and four. Five beers she had. And if there's anything I can tell you today that you can take to the bank, it's that she had five, because I have never met an Al-Anon that can't count. Arithmetic is our best subject. We can count and we can measure. The bottle was there. Let's see, it's down here. I'll just kind of add it up there. Al-Anon's the only person I know that can take a cork from a champagne bottle, you know, because they flare out, and shave it down so it'll fit back in the champagne bottle. You've had enough, dear. I don't think so. So they throw the cork back in the garbage and we go fishing for it. Yes, you have. Really, really. I love you. It's insane. Just insane. So we get up to the school, and I was about to find out that, you know, things can get real exciting, and I discovered that, I'll tell you, it's a lot better with another human being. I'm here to tell you that. It's great. And we played music, but there's even something better. There is something better if you're an Al-Anon like me. Because we'd have sex, we'd play music, and then she would tell me what was wrong with her, and I would tell her how to fix it. We had therapy. Oh, baby! And about 2 weeks into this union, I used to call it a relationship. Mildred calls it a parasitic entanglement. Heard another guy say one time, it's like two ticks without a dog. Eating away at each other. So whatever you want to call this thing, we were in it. And 2 weeks into this thing, she says these words to me. And if you're in Al-Anon, I want you to listen to this. She said, Rick, I've been seeing a therapist for a long time, but I don't need to see that therapist anymore because now I have you. Oh, yes! Yes! Absolutely! Alcohol doesn't do it for me. I'm walking around feeling like this gaping hole in my belly. What can I do to get approval? I don't need him, that therapist anymore because now I have you. Fill that up. You read that story in the big book about Bill, you know, taking his drink, feeling like he had arrived. I felt like I had arrived. I was that cock of the walk, literally. I'm walking along with her and thinking, hey, I belong. I mean, I honestly felt that. I honest to God did. I felt like I belonged with people. There's my illness, and nobody's doing that to me. I am doing that to me. Because I have a disease called alcoholism, the family disease. 6 weeks into this thing, we got home, and people are saying to me, for God's sake, Rick, what are you doing with this woman? And I'm saying, deep down inside, there's a beautiful person, and I'm going to help bring her out. Al-Anon, like me, loves a project, especially if it's an alcoholic woman. Fabulous. You can focus on it totally. But after a while, I got bored with it. Kind of like a dog that catches a car. What do you do with it when you get it? Well, you keep it. And you go find another one. You collect. You become a collector. And so I found myself, after I finished university, sitting in front of a principal of an inner city downtown high school, applying for a job to teach music, and we chatted for a while. And he said, Rick, we have a lot of very needy students in this school. Brother, I'm the man for you. Holy crow, I moved into that school. He said, you know, Rick, people say that these kids can't do a lot. Oh, really? Because I love a project. I love a project especially. If you tell me it can't be done, my sick mind goes, really? Just you watch me. I will do it, and then you will think I am fabulous, because on a deep level, I think I am garbage. But the only way that I can avoid that, because I have not accepted that there is a power. My mouth will say that, but I have not accepted it. That's the difference between fellowship and program. So these kids who weren't supposed to be able to do anything, 3 years later, we did a musical, Fiddler on the Roof, the whole thing, conducted the orchestra, put on everything, the whole play. And the Sunday afternoon performance, principal called me up from the pit in front of like a room, more people in there than this, hugged me in front of everybody, pushed me back but didn't let me go and looked me right in the eyes, and in front of all these people said, Rick, I've made a lot of decisions since I've been the principal of this school, but the best decision I ever made was to hire you. I showed them! That lasted for about a day. And then it goes away. And that's the thing, and that's the insanity of a self-run life. That's the insanity. We get it, we think we got it, it goes away. Go to get it again, it doesn't last as long, we go for more, and it drives us crazy. And we're in Al-Anon, and we're not drinking. And our lives are insane. We're choosing the same kind of people. We're obsessed with them. We don't even know our own names sometimes because all we can talk about is them. And this is going on inside us. Thank God there's a program for us. Our Al-Anon book says a few wonderful things about alcoholism, the family disease, and that it's us, not them. On March 12th, it says, the longer I'm in Al-Anon, the more clearly I perceive that alcoholism is indeed a sickness, a compulsion, an obsession, but haven't I too been afflicted with a sick compulsion? Wasn't I determined to save the alcoholic to the same degree that he was determined to drink? On March 4th, it says, many of my punishments are self-inflicted. In some way unfathomable to my human intelligence, my suffering could be the consequence of my own attitudes, actions, or neglects. This is in our Al-Anon literature. June 3rd, if we really do want peace of mind, the first thing we realize is that it does not depend on conditions outside us, but those inside us. And on July 27th, it says, Al-Anon's prime purpose is to help us deal with problems that alcoholism has aggravated. My sponsor says it like this, adding an alcoholic to a person like me is like sprinkling Miracle-Gro on my defects. Book was published in 1939. Safe to say it was being written in 1938. This is what it says. At the bottom of page 81. They knew this. Bill knew this. 1938. Published it in 1939. Our design for living is not a one-way street. It is as good for the wife as it is for the husband. In today's language, it's as good for the family as it is for the alcoholic. They knew that all those years later. And here in 2007, on May 26th, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, we still need to know that. That these 12 steps are as good for us as they are for the alcoholic. I did all kinds of other things. I had this obsessive anger problem. I loved being angry. Angry was kind of anger. Anger fills a gap, you see. So if you're not accepting a God, and you kind of have this vitriolic anger filled inside you, anger, of course, which is really fear, but if it's filled and it's spewing out all over the place, it kind of gave me this sense of being full, and I didn't feel so afraid all the time. And so when you teach high school and you have this venomous anger, it's not a good combination. I was walking down the hall one day, and a kid came up and touched my tie. Before I even knew what was going on, I had grabbed him, lifted it up, and pushed him out in the locker and put my fist against his face. Looked around, put him down, walked on, thinking, good thing nobody saw that. I would do things like that. I would scream and holler at kids in ways that I would have my staff members come over and say, are you okay? Nobody was doing that to me. That was my anger popping out. One day I'm at home alone, making a fried egg for dinner. Bachelor. Bachelors eat fried eggs for dinner. And I broke the yolk in the egg. Oh. I reached into the pan, picked up that goop, threw it against the wall, smashed the pan on the stove, looked around, and there was nobody there. It starts to pop. You can only suppress anger for so long, and it starts to ooze out, and fly out, and purge out. I came back to Al-Anon, I'm happy to... Oh, I married that trumpet player, by the way. She divorced me 3 years later, the ingrate. I was helping you! You're not helping me! You're never here! I was out fixing those kids at the school, that's what happened. Anyhow, where was I? Thank you. The anger started popping out. I went back to Al-Anon in April of 1987, but I forgot to tell people that I had stopped going to Al-Anon because I had been in for 16 years. You see, I had that ego. Yeah, I started in 1968. Aren't I so great? I know all the words. You can look up to me. And I was sick like a madman. I don't think there's anything more dangerous in our fellowships than somebody who knows the words but doesn't have any program. And that was me. There I was. And so I'm sharing at a meeting one day this BS about my marvelous spiritual experience, marvelous spiritual awakening I had. And there were about 80 people in my meeting, and two people beside me started playing with each other's shoelaces and giggling while the great one was sharing. Well, the anger that kid in the hallway saw, and the anger that happened when I was smashing that frying pan, those two people saw. And everybody in my group, they kind of took this collective gasp. The GRR is killing somebody at the back of the room. And at the end of the meeting, nobody would talk to me. How come? And it started to just pop out, guys. I mean, it just started to fly. Because I was there, you know, I'd kind of pretend to be this soft, gentle guy, but I was a madman inside. And I'd be standing at my meeting, you know, kind of looking at people, they'd be telling me things going on, and I'm thinking, I want to smack you right in the mouth. What do you look like if I kicked you right there? And these thoughts would come in. And I'd have thoughts coming in about doing things to me. And it's like, what is this? It's absolute pure insanity. And nobody at that time in my life is drinking. Nobody. And there I am. And that's happening. I didn't have a sponsor. My fault, not yours. I didn't ask anybody. I was the guy in the closet. I wanted you to come in, but I wouldn't come out and ask you to come in. So that's what was happening when I was doing fellowship. Standing on the sidewalk one day and a bus is coming down. Thought pops in. One step, Rick. It's over. Downtown one day near the water, walking by the kind of the pier, thought pops in. Just jump, Rick. It's over. I'm driving to work one morning. The thought pops in. Swerve the wheel, Rick. It's over. I have alcoholism, the family disease, and it was coming out of me. I wouldn't accept what I was being told in the fellowship about how to practice a program. I was arrogant, arrogant, arrogant. It's not going to work for me. There's nothing wrong with me, really. It's them. It's them. And I wanted to kill myself. Or I wanted to kill you. On a camp trip one time, tried to hit my wife with an axe. All she was doing was making dinner. I used to beat my wife up at night. Where's that coming from? I sought help, and what I discovered underneath the anger, underneath the terror, was fear. Just pure terror of life. And that's when these steps can kick in. Isn't that beautiful little prayer, one of the prayers in the fourth step in the big book? Says, you know, we ask God to remove the fear and to show us how we can kind of be what He wants us to be. It's a paraphrase, not an exact quote. But this program tells us how to work with fear. Because my anger was my protection. When I did my sixth step, my sponsor said, which defect are you having the hardest time letting go of? And I said, my anger. She said, what? I said, it's my friend. Who am I without it? Where's my power without it? She said, Rick, your power is a higher power, not you. What a fantastic thing to know. I loved being a victim. Being a victim is a choice, by the way. Being a victim is not something that happens to us. Being a victim is a choice. And I loved being a victim because when you're a victim, you're never wrong. Everybody else is always wrong. The victim is always pointing to the other. They did this, they did that, they did this. And we kind of whine. Yeah, it was them. You know the definition of whining? Anger escaping through a very small hole. So I was just whining. Now this is pathetic, really. Here I am, 35 years old. I've got a career, thank God, because I didn't kill any kid. And I'm still to this day, up to 35 years old, I'm in Al-Anon for a few years, blaming it all on them. And finally, in the simplest of ways, God's grace came into my life. And I was in a store in Toronto with a friend that I had met in the program, and we were on an escalator going downstairs, and she said this simple thing to me. She said, Rick, don't you think it's time to stop blaming your father for everything that's wrong with your life? Now, why that message hit me at that instant in time, I have no idea. But it did. And that was the real beginning of finally, truly accepting what this fellowship has to offer us. And what this fellowship has to offer us is the program. The program is 1 to 12. Al-Anon's tradition says we practice the 12 steps of AA ourselves. The program. Traditions, concepts, slogans, all this stuff is fellowship. And it's great. I need it. I want it. I love it. But the program is 1 to 12, and in my experience, done with a sponsor. So I finally asked, thank you. Actually, they're just fanning themselves. It's because I had never asked anybody. Now look at that. You're hanging around here for all those years and never say to somebody, will you be my sponsor? I never made that commitment with anybody. And I needed to. And so I started telling people about it. I said, you know what, I need to get a sponsor. So I kind of came up with this list of things. I had started to really cross that bridge. And I came up with a list, and of course it says, you know, men sponsor men, and women sponsor women, and you need to have somebody close by. And so I had this big long list, and I couldn't find anybody that fit the bill. And so I'm kind of wandering around. But what I did start to do is I started to pray about it. And I started to talk with my dear friend Mildred about it. Her and I get together once a week for a little meeting. And a person came to our town 13 years ago. She's speaking at a conference, and Friday night, after the Friday night speaker, we met up. Mildred introduced me to her. And we went out and we had a little bit of ice cream, and man, I liked what this person had. And on Saturday night, she told a story that just floored me. And on the way, after she finished, she came down to get me, and she said, "Hey, let's go get some more ice cream." And on the way through, right there by the Royal York, she said, "Hey, tell me about you, Rick." I said, "Well, I tried to chop up my wife's head with an axe on a camping trip." And she laughed. She just finished telling us a story about trying to drown her husband in a bathtub. And we identified. We bonded, the two potential murderers that we are. Because I left that off my list of potential sponsors, potential murder. I just left that off. I didn't think to put that on there. And so about 10 days later, Mildred and I are coming down to the U.S. We're going to Missouri for a retreat. And she says, "Have you found a sponsor yet?" And I said, no, I haven't. She said, "I think you have." I said, "Oh, Mildred, it's too crazy. It's just nuts. I'm a man. She's a woman. I live in Toronto. She lives so far away." And she said, "I saw something happen." I said, "I know. I thought something happened too." And so what we did, oh, God, thank God for the friends that we have in this fellowship. God, they can see for us what we can't see. They can. And may God bless you with people like that. They can see for you what you're just unable to see or unwilling to see at any given moment. And she said, "We'll keep praying about that." And so we went down, and for 5 days we prayed about it, and I wrote a letter finally. And I said, I love meeting you. I said, "I am sick to death of doing this by myself. I absolutely loved the program I heard you talk about, and I will do absolutely anything you ask me to do if you will be my sponsor." And I put it in the mail. 10 days later, I got a package. I thought, well, she talks a lot. Maybe she writes a lot, too. And there was a beautiful little letter in there. She said all kinds of things. She said, "I talked to my husband about this." And the bottom line was, she said, "Let's do it." And then she said this beautiful line: "Rick, welcome to the family." Put this in perspective. I started coming here when I was 11 years old. I left Al Team when I was 21. I left Al-Anon when I was 26. When I met that woman, I left and came back in 1987. I was hanging around here for 6-7 years. And I never felt like I was part of the family. Not because there wasn't family here, but because I had never gotten out of that closet enough to say, "Will you help me?" Because I was there. And God's grace came in. And I was able to get to that other side that says, "Oh my God, it's me, and I need help." And when we admit that as members of Al-Anon, we have available to us what I believe is the single most powerful tool for recovery on the planet. And it's the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous taken with a sponsor. When we do those 12 things, when we take those 12 directions, those 12 prescribed actions with somebody else, change happens. The promise is in step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. That is not a direction to action. It's a promise. Do 11 things, you're going to get this. And hey, by the way, you want to keep this? Do what Carl talked about so eloquently last night. Keep giving it away. Meet those other people. That's how we keep that. I had never done that, just being hung up on fellowship. So my sponsor said to me, she said, "Welcome to the family." It was the last nice thing she said to me for a year. She just said, "You are a sick flame in Al-Anon." And you, I said, "Yeah!" I took that as a compliment. This is the only place in the world where somebody says you're sick and you take it as a compliment. Whew, thank God. I belong here. So she said, "I don't care what step you've on. I don't care what you've done. You're going to start at the beginning." And she told me exactly how to do it. She said, "I want you to get every book that Al-Anon has." She said, "I want you to read the AA 12 and 12 and the AA Big Book." My smart ass mouth says, "The AA Big Book is an Al-Anon conference approved." Wrong thing to say to my sponsor. She said, "Listen, dummy. How on earth are you going to practice the 12 steps of AA yourself unless you use the book called AA? My keen intellectual mind understood that. I said, "Okay, I'll do it." And it has been a foundation for my recovery. I'm not dissing our Al-Anon literature. But Lois didn't have that. How can anybody 3 years sober write that book? I believe that God had a hand in there doing that. Right? Bill saw this white light, wrote this book. That didn't happen to Lois. She threw a shoe. How weenie is that? I belong to a fellowship that's saving my life because the wife of the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous threw her shoe at him. My mother threw butcher knives at my father, and she didn't start a program. I just don't get it. But anyhow, that's the fellowship that I belong to. So anyhow, she said, "You're going to do these 12 steps," and I did them, and I read that book. And when we finished step one, she said, "Congratulations, Rick. You've done step one to the best of your ability. Listen to this. Move on." Oh, take that in. Move on. I was like a hamster on a wheel. Tons of activity, no forward motion. Lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of movement, going nowhere. When you start to do the step with a sponsor, you move forward. Did two that way, did three that way, did four, wrote the inventory, got on an airplane, flew down to see her. Sat for 2 days, she listened to this whole thing, it's dossier. I'm having a guy coming in 2 weeks, he's got a dossier, holy God. So my sponsor said to me, some one day someone's going to show up at your door with one of these. He's coming on June 8th. Anyhow, we sat down, she listened to everything. We went out into her backyard after I did this fifth step, you know, read my fourth to her, doing the fifth, of course. And we burnt every page. Every page. Instead of prayer with every page. It was glorious. And we come back in, and I sit down in her kitchen with her, and I say, there is not a single thing I have not told you. And you know what she said to me? She said, Rick, I love you more because I know you better. Listen to that. Is that not one of our messages? I love you more because I know you better. My deepest fear was that if you knew me, you would loathe me. You would abhor what I had thought and done. You would banish me from your very presence, and I would be isolated forever. That was my fear. I wanted to get there, and my whole life I have been walking in that direction. And what the 12 steps practiced with a sponsor do is they take you, and they slowly point you in the right direction. By doing all these goofy things that we really don't want to do, we get pointed in the right direction, and we hear something like, I love you more because I know you better. And I have an ongoing relationship with that woman in July. It'll be 13 years. She's been sponsoring me. We talk on the phone every single Monday night, and that has happened for 13 years. And in 13 years, there's only one night that I did not phone. I'd been taking my students to a breakfast television show at Christmas time, and we were up at 4 a.m., and I fell asleep. I used to call at midnight. And she called me and said, Rick, are you okay? You've never missed. And my hallmark in my life was I was inconsistent. If I said I was going to be there, you could count that I wouldn't be. And when she called me and said, you never miss, it showed me that this thing was really starting to take place. And I found out what commitment was in that relationship, because early on, her sister had a heart attack. It's the only living relative that she has. And she called me and said, Rick, Dorothy had a heart attack today. I'm not going to be able to make her call. In the midst of the possibility of her only living relative dying, she remembered that she had a commitment with a guy in Toronto that wanted recovery. And in the midst of that, she didn't forget. She called me and let me know that she wasn't available, but if I needed to talk, call one of the other people that she sponsors. That, ladies and gentlemen, is what we do. That is so much better. So much better than hiding in that closet. That is so much better than sitting in these rooms feeling alone because I simply will not ask somebody, will you help me? I wouldn't do it. I was so arrogant and so afraid. And finally, God's grace came in. And I found someone that was willing to make that level of commitment to help me in my recovery. I really don't have any words to tell you what that kind of love is. Up to that point, I really had never experienced it. But as I got better, I realized that that love had been in my life all the time. That the parents that I have loved me that way. Disease got in the way. And it started to all kind of drop off as I worked those steps. I did 6, 7, I did the immense, I did the stuff. I'd love to tell you about all that. We're almost out of time. But I did the steps. And I started to get better. And people started to come to me and ask me if I would sponsor them, and I can share with them what my sponsor so freely and lovingly has shared with me. And I'll just tell two stories and of a real benefit of doing this stuff, and I'll sit down. One is my relationship. When I finished that relationship with the third alcoholic, my sponsor said to me, Rick, I think you need to take a break. She said, why don't you wait for 4 months? 4 months break. Now, guys, that means 4 months celibate, okay? Let's just get that in context. Sponsor speak. 4 months outside of a relationship means 4 months celibate. And so I said, you know, I think that's a good idea. And when I was down visiting my sponsor at New Year's, I said, hey, my 4 months is up tonight. She said, well, I've been meaning to talk to you about that. And she said, how about extending it to a year? And I said, hey, I think that's a good idea. And, and here I am thinking that, you know, at the end of the year, a Playboy Bunny is going to come walking through the door and it's going to be the end. And that really didn't happen. She said, Rick, you need to discover that it's possible to have a relationship with a woman that's not centered around sex. I didn't know that. She said, you need to find out that it's possible to have a female who is a friend. You need to find out that it's possible to go out with a woman a few times and find out that she may not be right for a relationship, but could still be a very good friend. You do not have to go out and be thinking about marriage 3 seconds after you meet her. Really, I didn't know that. The only thing I ever did fast in my life was that. And so I waited a year, and then I waited two, and then I waited three. And I'll tell you, after 3 years, I said, to hell with it. You know, 4 years came and went. I'm going for the record, man. It's like, to heck with it. I learned to iron my own shirts. I bought my own food. I just started living. I had all kinds of great friends. I'd gone out with women a few times and realized, great person. I don't want to have a relationship with you. What an incredible experience that was. Then one day, I'm sitting at an Al-Anon day in Toronto. I'm sitting at the back. There's an empty chair beside me, and this woman comes over to sits down beside me, and I look over, a beautiful blonde, and I put out my hand and say, hi, my name's Rick. She says, yes, I know who you are, and I think, the drought just might be over. And it was. But I didn't use our rooms as a dating place. I didn't 13th step her. I phoned her friend and said, could you ask Lise if I could have her phone number, and I want to phone her, and it's not an Al-Anon call. It's a man-to-woman call. Lise said, yes, I called. And 7 years later, she's here at the Gopher State Roundup with me for the second time. God love you, hon. Beautiful. A fantastic member of Al-Anon, she is. My father, sober for 25 years and drank again. Go figure. What is that about? I have no idea. I'm not going to tell his story. And that really threw me. I had developed a fantastic relationship with my father. We had done all kinds of great things. We could have these fantastic chats. And when drinking came in, it ended that. And so I needed to reuse this program to understand I can be the best son I can be to an active alcoholic. He doesn't have to be sober for me to be the best I can be. And that was a challenge for me. 1 year ago today, Lise threw for me a 50th birthday party. And my father, in his birthday card, wrote this little note. It's right here. My father's 75 years old. He said, Rick, some good news. I'm 9 days sober. Yes, I have returned to AA. And I want to tell you people that you are doing for my father what I did not even try to do. All I did when my father went back to drinking was love my father. Because you see, my father is a wonderful human being. He's a kind, loving, generous, intellectual man who has a disease called alcoholism. And it came back. And after 7 years, he came back to you. And you, once again, are welcoming him into your fold. And my life has not changed because my father is not drinking. But it is always a happy, 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 happy thing when someone you love is involved in health rather than sickness. So I send to you my appreciation for what you are doing for a man that I love deeply. I end with this story. My sponsor told me to end with the story all the time, so I do. My father and I wanted to establish a relationship with my dad. We had such a difficult time, and so we started doing things together as adults, and we started canoeing and did a one-day canoe trip, a two-day canoe trip. And one day we said, well, hey, let's do a real long one. So we decided to take the 16-day canoe trip up so far in northern Canada that the sun didn't set. Took four airplanes to get there. This plane landed on a gravel bar beside the river. It's raging whitewater river. And dropped us off and said, 16 days that way. See you later. And there I am with my dad. And there's a guide and another fellow, so there were two canoes and four people. One canoe had the guide and another guy, and then the other canoe was my dad and me. And so the guide had to teach us how to maneuver a canoe on this raging whitewater river. It's called the Nahanni River up in the Northwest Territories. And so one of the tricks on a canoe is that you need to stop it. Right? So you have to do this thing called an eddy turn. And so the guide the first day would tell us, you know, do this, 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 and this, and the boat will turn around and you'll kind of glide into the shore and you can get out of the boat. Good, good. So we try that. Dad's, you know, listening to the guy. We get it. Hey, way to go. Pop. High five. Next day, we have to get out of the boat. So we make the eddy turn. Dad's saying, hey, Rick, do this, this, this. Yeah, hey, Dad, this is cool. Shh, done. High five. Day three, we have to get out of the boat. Dad's telling me how to do things. I'm thinking, Dad, I don't know how to do the eddy turn. Do I say that? No. I just stuff it down, and there's the beginning of the resentment. I feel it, and I don't say it. That's when you feel it, that's a sentiment. When you feel it again, that's a resentment. All right, so day four, he tells me again, do I say, Dad, I know how to do it? No. And it starts to build, and it starts to grow, and it starts to explode. Day seven or eight, he says, we're stopping for lunch. My dad tells me, do this, this, and this, and it just comes out of me. I scream at the top of my lungs, I know how to make a goddamn eddy turn. And I turn around and look at him, and at that exact moment in time, he feels it's the best time to say to me, I love you. What? And that was it. That was it. The keen alcoholic mind. And an octopus went on my face, and I was pissed the rest of the trip. And I get home, and I call my sponsor. She said, how was your trip? You want to hear about this trip? I'll tell you about the trip. And I get into this screaming litany about the trip and finally stop for breath, and she dives in because a good sponsor will ask a question and hover. And she dives in and says, tell me something good. I couldn't think of a thing. She says, you mean to tell me you were away for 16 days in the most beautiful country you can imagine and there wasn't a single good thing that happened? Can't think of one. She gave me an assignment. She said, I want you to write down a list of all the good things that happened. I said, okay. Following Monday, I call her, say, I have my list. I had seven things. I read her the list. Another assignment came. She said, I want you to write your dad a letter. A lot of my recoveries happen with letters. Write your father a letter and tell him all this. I said, do I have to mail it? She said, yes, you do. And so I wrote my dad a love letter. I said, Dad, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for the trip down to the honey. Dad, I want to thank you for helping me about with the bit with the cost. It was expensive. I needed the help, but thanks for helping me. Dad, I want to tell you how proud I am that you knew more about the geography, about the wildlife, about everything than the guide. My father was teaching the guide about things that were going on. I was proud of my dad. I said, Dad, I hope when I'm your age, I will have the physical stamina to do the kind of trip that we just took. And then I said, Dad, I want to thank you for helping me down the mountain. Because you see, one of the activities on the trip was to take a hike up a mountain. I'm afraid of heights. We get halfway up the mountain, stop, everybody's looking around, the other three guys, they're thinking, wow, this is fantastic. I'm thinking, too high, too far. And the break stops, the other guys start proceeding up the mountain. They look at me, say, are you coming? I say, I don't think so. And a magic happened with my dad. He looked at them, he looked at me, and he said, I'm going to go down with Rick. And my father let his adult son down the mountain. He didn't ridicule me, didn't make fun of me, didn't do anything. My adult father brought me down. We got to the bottom, we just hung out, the other guys came down. I forgot that, because you see, in my sickness, I don't see that stuff. But a sponsor can help me see that. And so I wrote that in the letter. And as I was walking up the street to put that letter in the mailbox, I said, here's some action I'm taking. This is concrete action. He's going to get this. But 4 days later, he called me. He was crying. He said, son, I got your letter. He said, Rick, it's the most beautiful thing I've ever received in my life. He said, whenever I feel down, I'm going to keep this by my bed and I'm going to read it. He said, I love you, son. I said, I love you too, Dad. Amazing what can happen when we're willing to take the actions. Today, that letter is in the photograph album of the trip, and everybody who gets to see the photograph album gets to read my letter. It's his letter. He can do with it whatever he wants. This has been great. What a fantastic group you are. What a fantastic place this is in Minneapolis. Hold on to what you've got. Be proud of what you have. Keep the legacy that has been given to you going, because it is strong, it is powerful, and it saves lives, and it is certainly helping me. There's a picture that stands on an altar in a side chapel, St. Paul's Cathedral in London, England. At the top of the picture, it says, the light of the world. It's a picture of a traditional robed figure standing with its right hand raised, knocking on the door of a cottage. Has a lantern in the left hand. Below it says, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come into him and have supper with him and he with me. And as every single one of us knows, that the only way that that door is going to open is when the person on the inside grabs the handle and pulls it open. Because my God was knocking on my door for a long, long time before I was willing to open it up and let the beauty of what this program is into my life. My sponsor said to me when she first started sponsoring me, she said, Rick, you cannot think your way into right action. You must act your way into right thinking. And the actions you must take are called the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. God bless you all. Thanks for having me in Minnesota.